and reported in a state of feigned hysteria that he had been kidnapped by two men and thrown in the back of a laundry truck. It was only through good fortune, he said, that he was able to escape. The police believed Bruce and had him go through books of mugshots in an attempt to find the bad guys. Dad and Mom were contacted, and they drove to the police station. A detective there assured Mr. and Mrs. Herbert that he would investigate the case thoroughly and would find whoever had done this terrible thing. Their son was fortunate to be alive, he said. In our San Francisco house, we had a number of large brown corduroy pillows, triangular in shape, which we used to lean against while reading or while watching the little black-and-white television. They were foam-filled. Bruce had one on his bed. After coming home from the police station, he went in his room and lay on the bed, with his head on the big pillow. It was quiet in the house. Then he heard familiar footsteps on the hardwood of the hallway, and his pulse raced. Dad opened the bedroom door, stared in at Bruce, and said, "You were lying, weren't you?" Under the piercing, see-it-all stare, Bruce coughed. He felt his eyes burning, expected to see his father pull off the wide leather belt and administer the usual. But Dad said in a calm tone, "I'm not going to spank you this time, but you're grounded for 2 weeks. Come straight home after school every day and do extra chores." In 1962, science fiction writers Frank Herbert, Jack Vance, and Paul Anderson went into partnership to construct a houseboat. I helped them, performing odd tasks such as painting the top white in blinding sunshine. The boat sank in a storm that year, and Dad lost every penny he had invested in it. While working on the vessel, the men plotted a collaborative science fiction story. It was about a master thief whose specialty was underwater capers. They planned to publish it under the pseudonym Noah Arkwright, so named in honor of their partnership. Because of work pressures, Jack and Paul couldn't get to the project, and a few years later, Dad wrote it himself under the title The Primitives, Galaxy, April 1966. In the summer of 1963, when I had just turned 16, I decided I needed a real job. I had been washing cars and doing landscaping in the neighborhood, but I wasn't earning enough money to buy the car that I wanted. Dad suggested that I apply for part-time jobs at the three major San Francisco newspapers. In August, the Examiner called and offered me a copyboy position at $1.25 an hour. Just before I reported to the X, Dad took me aside and told me of a Mexican phrase, la ñapa, meaning the addition. It referred to something given as an extra, without remuneration, like the 13th item in a baker's dozen. There is a Creole French counterpart, la ñap, sounding very similar since both are from a Latin root. What a wonderful concept this is. Imagine what the world would be like if everyone followed it in all their relationships. He told me to follow this principle in my work at the Examiner and in every job I held during my life. Always produce more than they pay you for, he said. That way, they'll want to keep you around. This was a credo he had been following all of his working life. In the Santa Rosa Barrier, 1968, his protagonist, Dacine, felt antipathy toward the society represented by his employers. But he also felt a compulsion somewhere within him to make an honest report to those who'd hired him. His own remembered sense of duty urged it. To do anything else would be a form of dishonesty, an erosion of selfdom. He felt a jealous possessiveness about his self. No smallest part of it was cheap enough to discard. Dad was the night picture editor, with responsibility for selecting photographs to be included in the paper and for writing captions beneath the photos. In this position, his experience as photographer, reporter, and freelance writer served him well. His desk was by a window, near the curved rim of the copy desk and the city desk. His 4 p.m. to midnight schedule usually differed from mine, so I only rarely worked when he was there. In the fall of 1963, Dad bought a 1959 Volkswagen camper from one of Jack Vance's musician friends, a car dealer named Earl Sheeler in Berkeley. It was orange and cream-colored, with a sunroof, sink, refrigerator, small table, and bunks for two. Dad put a bumper sticker on the rear, "Give to mental health, or I'll kill you." He drove the camper to the Examiner every day. On his lunch or dinner breaks, depending upon his schedule, he wrote at the table of the camper with a ballpoint pen, or set a timer and napped. A heavy sleeper, He could fall asleep in seconds, so the timer was a necessity. He said he didn't write that much in the van, that mostly he slept in it from the fatigue of getting up as early as he could each day to write before work. In his spare time, Dad was always inventing things, much as his father had done before him. In Frank Herbert's case, most of his inventions consisted of descriptions of gadgets in his futuristic science fiction stories. Typically, he conceived a world and the people to populate it, and then postulated the technology they might require. Thus, he came up with an expandable underwater oil barge in The Dragon in the Sea to transport petroleum during dangerous wartime conditions, and in Dune, steel suits to recover precious wastewater from the body in the extreme desert conditions of the planet. These novels were filled with other inventions.
His 1965 short story, Committee of the Whole, described a homemade laser weapon, the secrets of which were released to the public by a madman who happened to think like Frank Herbert.
Dad believed such technology should be made available to everyone, thus preventing dangerous people from monopolizing weapons and using them for their own ends. He wrote, "One man could destroy an aerial armada with it, knock down ICBMs before they touched atmosphere, sink a fleet, pulverize a city." In the 1970s, he would write a highly inventive film treatment, entitled initially Jonathan Lay and then Asa West. It did not sell, but not for lack of imagination. Set on an alien planet, it described a RoboCop-type character, a man in an armored mask who was part human and part synthesized machine, with superhuman powers. Dad referred to his creation as SuperCop, a virtually unstoppable fighting machine. It had the power to detect lies and could not be poisoned or gassed. Its body had pockets concealed by invisible skin flaps, compartments that contained many incredible weapons and tools. I found one device particularly interesting in view of my father's passion for the outdoors. He called it a caster, which, like a fishing pole, released a fine line and seeker tip to retrieve whatever SuperCop wanted. In the early 1950s, Dad invented a special type of slide rule that he never got around to patenting. With a lifelong interest in cooking and guns, he also came up with what he called a spice gun. This was an ingenious device that looked like a target pistol, with a long, sharp-pointed barrel on the end that was inserted into a roast. When the spice gun trigger was pulled, it injected spices into the meat. The tip was removable, with a second snap-on tip that had grating slots in it for injecting garlic juice. Inspired by a conversation with Howie Hansen about the workings of a sextant, Frank Herbert also devised a navigation instrument that, in Howie Hansen's words, used a beam of light to shine down into the inside of an arc to pinpoint a position. During slow times at the Examiner, Dad developed his own one-panel cartoon series, which I named Tingle when I saw the characters. They were simple lines forming people who looked like bent coat hangers. The basic cartoon person was a long, slightly curved vertical line, bending out where the derriere would be, with a horizontal connected line at the bottom representing feet. A not-quite-closed circle was attached on top, representing a head. The figure had no arms. He drew a witch's hat on one, with the caption, "Anyone call for a doctor?" Another figure had no hat, but the middle section was curved, as in a drainpipe under a kitchen sink. "Did you call for a plumber?" the caption read. He also drew what he called Zen cartoons. One was a horizontal line with an arrow on each end, with the caption, "A longer line than the other one." Another cartoon had an arrow pointing down, above the word up, and the caption, "Up under some circumstances." In addition to their own Hearts card game variation, my parents also came up with a silly parlor game called Frog It. To demonstrate, Dad would tell his dinner guests to talk in the tone of a frog croaking. Like this, he said, "Frog it, frog it, frog it." After the guests practiced a bit, Dad would ask, "What's a noun frog?" And when no one came up with an answer, he said, "Habit, habit, habit." Then Mom might ask, "What's a jeweler frog?" Another pause, and then, "Lock it, lock it, lock it." "And what are the four Safeway frogs?" Dad asked. "Why, stack it, pack it, stock it, and bag it." And so on, they would improvise. In another improvisation described by Howie, my father would begin by saying, in a creaking, aged hillbilly accent, "Ma?" To which she would respond in like accent, her voice also creaking, Yes, Pa? After a long pause. Ma, I got something to say. Yes, Pa, what is it? Ma, I'm a-goin'. I'm a-goin', Ma. Yes, Pa, and what is it you want to say? Another pause. I want to say I'm a-goin', Ma, but before I go, I've got something to say. Yes, Pa, I'm a-goin', Ma. It would go on like this for several minutes, to the amusement of all present. Early in the 1960s, Dad learned that a British company had developed flexible underwater barges based upon his concept in The Dragon in the Sea. The company was marketing them under the trade name Dracone, and as this name suggested, they freely admitted the source of the idea. Science fiction authors Arthur C. Clarke and Fritz Lieber, friends of Dad, recommended that he take legal action to invalidate Dracone's patents. Dad consulted a number of people on this, including John W. Campbell, and learned from them, to his dismay, that he should have filed formal patent papers within 2 years of publication of his idea. The publication gave him discovery rights for that period, but his failure to file proper documents sent the idea into the public domain. But an even bigger fish would be lost by my father as a result of this. Eventually, The Dragon in the Sea would be published in Japan, where it would become very popular. The Japanese admitted creating overseas shipping containers as an adaptation of Dad's underwater barge concept. Upon completion of the three segments of Dune, Dune World, Muad'Dib, and The Prophet, in November 1963, Dad embarked upon a 2.5-month leave of absence from The Examiner. He did some writing during that period, but mostly recuperated. He planned to take a vacation trip to the Pacific Northwest just before Christmas, and after that, he intended to return to the newspaper. Aside from the analog serialization of Dune World, a very important sale, Dad sold only a couple of articles in 1963 to the San Francisco Examiner, for which he was paid small amounts in addition to his salary. Mom left her job at the White House department store and went to work in the advertising department of Macy's in San Francisco. She also wrote freelance for Plan Ahead, a national guide for advertising copywriters. She was working on a new mystery novel, too, entitled Marked Down for Murder. Her first novel, Frighten the Mother, which needed major rewriting, lay languishing in a file cabinet. She hadn't worked on it for several years. At the age of 16, I started drinking with friends and experienced several near misses with death, invariably involving cars and alcohol. On occasion, my parents had to bail me out of jail, where I had been placed in the drunk tank. The last time this happened, my mother said to me, "I've cried my last tear for you." As a result of a number of open confrontations between me and my father, she also told me that if she had to choose between us, she would choose him. My little brother was in trouble with Dad on a constant basis, over picayune matters. Sometimes Bruce looked in the refrigerator a little too long and couldn't make up his mind what he wanted, keeping the door open and wasting electricity. This was a violation of one of Dad's many house rules.
Or Bruce left the lid loose on the strawberry jelly, causing Dad to drop it and break it when he lifted it from the shelf by the lid.
Or from his fascination with things electrical and electronic, Bruce wore the batteries out on every flashlight in the house. Or he didn't get good enough grades, despite scholastic aptitude tests indicating an extremely high IQ. Bruce's relationship with his father was, in its own way, worse than mine. I confronted Dad, venting my anger, but my brother never did. This proved to have devastating consequences for the young man, as his pent-up rage and frustration would lead him to make very bad, even dangerous decisions. Chapter 16. Honors. Jack Vance was a member of Mystery Writers of America and earned considerable success in the field, winning an Edgar one year for the best novel. Through his encouragement, my mother and father made efforts to write and sell in that genre. Early in 1964, Mom completed a new 65,000-word novel, Marked Down for Murder, and sent it off to Lurton for his efforts. She had not sold a piece of creative writing since the sale of Corner Movie Girl to Modern Romances in 1946, but had never given up hope that one day she might become a published author. For many years, she had been an avid reader of murder mysteries, so it was in this field that she felt most comfortable now. Unfortunately, Lurton had difficulty placing her novel, and finally gave up. This book, like her earlier one, would need extensive rewriting, he said. Dad, also interested in the genre, joined Mystery Writers of America. He was eligible for membership because of his publication credits in the science fiction genre, but my mother, without credits, could not join. In the spring of 1964, Dad sent a mystery novelette to Lurton, The Heat's On. The agent was unable to find a publisher for it. He praised it as an interesting story, but said it was of a length that was no longer popular. Worst of all, Dune in book form still had not found a publisher, as Sterling E. Lanier and Chilton Book Company were still a year down the road. On their 18th wedding anniversary that June, Dad gave Mom a bouquet of 18 red roses with a handwritten note on a card. Darling, will you renew my option? Love, Frank. Of course she did. And sometimes on special occasions, she sent him singing telegrams via Western Union. Around this time, Mom increased her pressure on Dad to buy a house. They considered Santa Barbara to the south, where a number of Dad's uncles and aunts had settled, or the Santa Cruz Mountains, near the home of his author friend Robert Heinlein. But these were not practical locations. My father's writing income remained low, and for the near future he needed to stay tethered to the Examiner. Beverly Herbert left Macy's, hoping to concentrate more on her creative writing and on freelance work for Plan Ahead. She was despondent, however, over Marked Down for Murder, and thought she might be better off starting a new yarn. Dad told her she should rewrite her two novels, that both were potentially publishable. Subsequently, she tinkered with them, then tried an entirely new yarn, and finally gave up creative writing altogether, with the exception of a handful of Christmas stories that were published as department store advertising supplements. Within weeks, my parents applied for and obtained two bank loans. With the first, they bought a house in Fairfax, 20 miles north of San Francisco, over the Golden Gate Bridge. With the second, they purchased a 56-acre unimproved parcel 140 miles north, near Willits. The Willits property was wooded with fir, cedar, and pine trees, and had a long dirt road leading to a cleared building site where a previous owner had planned to construct a home. This remote property was Dad's ultimate destination. While living in Fairfax, he intended to spend weekends constructing a home in Willits, doing the work himself, along with volunteer labor from Jack Vance, me, and anyone else willing to lend a hand. Dad intended to establish a small subsistence farm there, thus returning to the rural roots of his boyhood, a halcyon life that had been beckoning to him for years. He also intended to experiment on the farm with a number of alternative energy methods, such as solar and wind power, and power from methane obtained from chicken droppings. Years later, these experiments would become famous as Frank Herbert's Ecological Demonstration Project. One day that summer, Mom and Dad were at a laundromat in Fairfax. Our recently acquired tabby cat, Pumpkin, strolled in. Assuming he had followed them, they took him home in the car and carried him inside. There they were startled to find Pumpkin already asleep on the knit rug by the fireplace. Quickly, Dad returned the imposter to the laundromat. This became the seed of a new short story, The Wrong Cat, which Dad wrote in a few days. The story, while it featured a mix-up between two cats, involved quite a different situation. It was a 7,600-word mystery that Dad wrote under the pseudonym Stuart McCarthy. This name was a combination of my mother's Stuart family name on her father's side and Dad's McCarthy name on his mother's side. As a member of Mystery Writers of America, Frank Herbert planned to write a number of mysteries under the pseudonym. Lurton was not favorably impressed with The Wrong Cat, saying the solution to the story was too obvious. He also expressed concern over my father's recurring problem, story length. It was too long for a mystery short story, and too short for a novelette, the latter being a category of increasing interest to publishers. Still, Lurton did his best to sell it as written. He was unsuccessful. That fall, I went away to Berkeley in the East Bay, renting a little room just off campus on the second floor of a turn-of-the-century house. I was barely 17 years old. Due to real estate expenditures, our family finances were tight, but I was used to that. I worked for part of my tuition and room and board at the school cafeteria and at a bookstore run by a lively old woman in her 90s who still drove a car. It was an interesting historical time to be at the University of California at Berkeley, a campus of 27,000 students. The free speech movement was germinating there, a movement that would spread to college campuses all across the country. I majored in sociology. In addition to his picture editor duties, Dad wrote feature stories, some about the student unrest at Berkeley. The campus situation there reached such epidemic proportions of madness and chaos that Dad coined the name Berserkly for the university community. This had a certain ring to it, and soon the term came into common parlance around the Bay Area. Dad had two short stories published in the fall of 1964, The Mary Celeste Move, Analog, October, and The Tactful Saboteur, Galaxy, October. Celeste was a science fiction mystery, expertly drawn, in which a peculiar phenomenon of human behavior was investigated. Saboteur originally had a working title of What Did He Really Mean By That?, but Frederick Pohl of Galaxy renamed it The Tactful Saboteur. This was the second story to feature George X. McKee following A Matter of Traces in 1958. McKee would later appear in the novels Whipping Star, 1970, and The Dosati Experiment, 1977. He was a humorous, gnome-like character, sometimes involved with making governmental agencies look foolish. Also in the fall of 1964, Dad completed his second science fiction ecology book, The Green Brain, a novel about insects that created a powerful artificial intelligence in reaction to human attempts to eradicate them. The story concept was an extrapolation of modern conditions on Earth, in which insects developed a resistance to insecticides, such as DDT. Amazing published a short story version, Green Slaves, in its March 1965 issue. Ace Books purchased the softcover rights to the novel for publication in 1966. The Green Slaves title had historical significance in our family, since our reputed ancestor, King Henry VIII, was said to have composed the classic song Greensleeves. Ecology was one of the recurring themes and sub-themes of Frank Herbert's stories. In a later novel, Direct Descent, 1980, it would become a background detail. The central story thread concerned an ancient library, but mention was made of Sequoia gigantica trees, much loved by my father, trees said in the story to have only survived on a remote island of Earth. It was shortly after the sales of Green Slaves and The Green Brain that Chilton Books made the offer to publish Dune in hardcover. Suddenly, the name Frank Herbert was starting to mean something in the publishing world. He completed a short story, Do I Wake or Dream?, about artificial intelligence. Galaxy picked up the serialization rights for their August 1965 issue. Dad wrote an expanded version entitled Destination Void, and Berkeley Publishing Group purchased the paperback rights to it, also for publication in 1966. Two more of his short stories were published in 1965, Committee of the Whole, Galaxy, April, and The GM Effect, Analog, June. In Committee, one of many Frank Herbert stories with a political theme, politicians are made to look foolish. For the author, oft frustrated by the conundrums of politics, this story was cathartic. GM touched upon a recurring Frank Herbert theme as well, genetic engineering. And in this case, as in Dune, he dealt with the issue of genetic memories that might be housed in the cells of all humans. In GM, instead of a Bene Gesserit sisterhood bearing such memories, Dad explored the possibility of genetic imprints revealing unsavory information about some of the most heroic figures in history, including Abraham Lincoln and Jesus Christ. During the next decade, Dad would explore other aspects of genetic engineering. In the novel The Eyes of Heisenberg, 1966, humans were genetically individualized through processes known only to a select group of rulers. Just a chosen few were permitted to have children in the traditional manner, and then under strict laboratory conditions. In the short story Come to the Party, 1978, written with F.M. Busby, the writers dealt with the questions of long-dormant technical abilities revealed when ancient racial memories were brought to the surface. In The White Plague, 1982, Dad wrote of the catastrophic consequences of uncontrolled genetic engineering, in which a terrible plague was unleashed intentionally upon the women of the world. Early in 1965, when Dad was 44, he quit his job at the Examiner in order to devote more energy to writing. In addition to Mom's work for Plan Ahead, she freelanced, writing advertisements for a variety of department stores. Now both of my parents were free from the regimens of steady jobs. It was a good thing, too, because the commute from Marin County to San Francisco was getting crowded. Tens of thousands of people had recently moved to the Bay Area from all points of the globe. When he wasn't writing, Dad began drawing up plans to remodel the Fairfax house. He wanted to expand the living room, enlarge the garage to accommodate two cars, and put on new exterior siding and interior paneling. A restless man who was never content with his surroundings, he was always looking ahead, always planning. His mind went in 50 directions at once.
On the strength of the Dune serializations in analog, Dad was invited to be guest of honor at the 1965 WesterCon Science Fiction Convention, held in Long Beach, California.
In his speech, he spoke of the haiku from which Dune sprang, and to demonstrate the concept, he went on to reduce War and Peace, Moby Dick, The Grapes of Wrath, and other long classic novels to haiku or tanka form, entire novels in only 17 or 31 syllables. This was an example of his remarkable, cultured sense of humor. He brought the house down with laughter and applause. My father was always impatient to achieve his plans. He had goals that were constantly eluding him. Now, for the first time, he could taste success, could feel it coming. But money was slow in arriving. He and Mom weren't earning enough, and they still owed back taxes to the IRS. The Willetts' property had become an emotional and financial drain. The prior winter storm had washed out the access road, requiring extensive bulldozer work. The property was more than a two-hour drive from Fairfax, too far away for a busy man to construct a home there part-time, especially with limited funds. Mom convinced Dad to sell it. Reluctantly, he agreed and advertised it. Shortly after the WesterCon convention, Dad went back to work at the Examiner 4 to 5 days a week. Abashedly, he told friends it was only on a short-term emergency basis, at the request of the paper. In reality, he and the paper needed each other. Chilton published Dune in August 1965, a thick hardcover with more than 500 pages and a retail price of $5.95. It included a number of expanded passages, including stronger roles for some characters. A number of new epigrams were added as well, along with a glossary of terms and a map of the planet Dune, based upon my father's drawing. Four appendixes were included too, providing important background information on the ecology, religion, history, and politics of the planet. For the book jacket, Chilton selected a John Schoenhaire painting of Paul and Jessica crouching in a shadowy canyon. It was a dramatic scene with considerable sentimental appeal to my father. One day he would purchase the original art, along with other paintings by the same artist. The first printing of Dune was only 3,500 copies, a typical hardcover run for the time. Of that amount, 1,300 were misprinted and had to be discarded. As a result, only 2,200 copies reached bookstores. Because of this small first printing and other factors, a first edition of Dune has become more valuable than any book in science fiction history. The first edition has a blue cover with white lettering. As noted by Lavoc and Willard in Dune Master, a Frank Herbert bibliography, the first edition states first edition on the copyright page, no date on the title page. The fifth and later printings all state first edition without further printing statements. Dad enlisted assistance from the DFPA advertising firm in Tacoma, and they did promotional work in the Pacific Northwest on the book gratis. He arranged with a few local bookstores to carry the book and distributed 25 promotional copies to newspaper editors and columnists, as well as to radio and television commentators he knew in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle. This was all he had the time or resources to do. A month after publication, Chilton arranged to have a 2-minute advertisement run on the Inside Books radio program, including an excerpt from the novel. This was broadcast to 500 commercial and educational stations and another 170 Veterans Administration hospital stations. Chilton also mailed a few copies of Dune to reviewers around the country. All in all, the book did not receive much promotion. Dune came to the attention of only a few reviewers, and those who cared to look at it wrote scathing commentaries. They hated the book, said it was too long and difficult to understand. Not surprisingly, my father became embittered against reviewers, referring to them privately as poseurs and frustrated authors, people who attempted to boost their own shaky egos by denigrating the works of others. He often said that the only valid critic was time. If his work endured, he said, the comments of critics meant nothing. From its 8-part serialization in analog, which had a large circulation, science fiction readers and writers were already quite familiar with the story and liked it. Arthur C. Clarke and Anne McCaffrey were among the first science fiction fantasy writers to extol the virtues of the book. Clarke knew of nothing comparable to Dune, with the exception of J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. An epic story with larger-than-life Machiavellian characters, Dune would soon become the standard against which other works were compared. It would be called the greatest novel of imagination of all time. Science fiction writers voted Dune the 1965 Nebula Award for Best Novel, shared with Roger Zelazny's And Call Me Conrad. The award was in the shape of a rectangular piece of clear plexiglass on a square black pedestal, with a swirling, glittering, three-dimensional nebula over a beautiful fragment of white, silver, and lavender quartz. It measured 9 inches high by 4 inches square around the base, and weighed 6 pounds. Dad placed the award on the windowsill of his Fairfax study so that it was visible against a backdrop of oak and bay trees that sloped down the hillside from the house. He described the award as a work of art and, with tongue-in-cheek, suggested that there should be an award for the award. Other science fiction awards, he said, often resembled glistening phallic symbols. Cal Berkeley was astir with political activity. The world-famous free speech movement wasn't the only issue on campus. Most students were opposed to the war in Vietnam and the draft. They favored civil rights and women's rights and the allied free choice issue of abortion. They turned in or burned draft cards, held sit-ins at draft boards, burned brassieres in public, and generally railed against anything that smacked of the establishment. Long-haired, bearded protesters were out every day on campus with signs and bullhorns. They set up tables on the paved commons between the administration building and the Associated Student Union building, from which they distributed political literature. One day they commandeered a police car on campus and took over the administration building. Finding myself unable to identify with the protesters, I didn't participate in the vibrant intellectual atmosphere of the school, though history and hindsight indicate that their free speech and anti-war causes were justified. I didn't care for their methods. They taunted people trying to attend class and blocked entrances. They thrust flyers in front of us. The constant blare of their bullhorns outside class was a distraction from my studies. As far as I was concerned, the political activists were dirty, smelly hippies. To a large extent, they wanted a free and easy life, without obligations or responsibilities. Free love, flower children, uptight, out of sight, groovy, like, wow, the new left. So many new phrases and concepts entered the lexicon in those days. They were bohemians, real and mock, straight out of Kerouac's On the Road. When they opposed something, they rarely offered alternatives. My negative opinions about the protesters of the day were formed in no small part by the fact that my father was a bohemian who wore a beard.
He spent a lot of time in the North Beach area of San Francisco and often showed up in City Lights bookstore, operated by Kerouac's friend, Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Ferlinghetti agreed to stock Dune and featured it in a window display. When I was at Berkeley between 1964 and 1968, I was in the college drinking crowd, a binge drinker. Perhaps this explains why I heard very little mentioned about Dune or Frank Herbert. Besides, Dune was slow to get going. Chilton would not go into a second hardcover printing until 1968, my last year at the university. Ace printed a relatively small number of paperback copies in 1966, and they too went into a second printing in 1968. One evening, I was hitchhiking near Carmel, California. A young couple in a Volkswagen Bug gave me a ride. They asked me what my dad did for a living, and I replied that he was a newspaper man and had also written a couple of science fiction books. "Oh," the man said as he drove, "what has he written?" A novel back in the 1950s, and another one more recently. Dune. "Dune!" the man exclaimed. causing the car to veer as he looked back at me in the shadows of the rear seat. "That's a great book."
"It is," I said.
Then, unfortunately, I forgot about this incident until years later.
Just before Christmas 1966, Dad sold the Willetts property. "We'll buy another piece when we can afford it," he said.
By this he meant, of course, another piece on which he could have his farm.
In 1966, science fiction readers voted Dune the Hugo Award as the best science fiction novel of the year. This award was a futuristic stainless steel rocket, 14 inches tall, atop a maple base 6 inches square by 4.5 inches high, with a total weight of 4 pounds. It was presented to my father at the World Science Fiction Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. He displayed it proudly on the windowsill of his Fairfax study next to the Nebula Award. A rumor made the rounds that Dune also won the International Fantasy Award, but this, like similar rumors about The Dragon in the Sea, was inaccurate. Dune was the first novel to win both the Nebula and Hugo Awards. For years, Dad kept copies of bad reviews, and as Dune became more successful, he retaliated by reading the remarks of critics at science fiction conventions and at writing conferences when he knew the authors of those pieces would be present. At one convention, he confronted Harlan Ellison over an unfavorable review he had written years before on The Dragon in the Sea, disputing every point Ellison had made. These men, who had never met before, became fast friends. Though revenues remained small, Dune was earning a little more each year. "I feel a groundswell building," my father said. He was more convinced than ever that he had an important literary property on his hands. He was being told by respected people that he had elevated the quality of science fiction and had written a new novel form, one with complex layers that reached beyond science fiction to the heady realm of literature. While Frank Herbert made many predictions that came true, including the eventual success of Dune, he was quite circumspect about those he made. When he spoke of the future, he drew a distinction between the future and a future. There were any number of possible futures that might occur, he said, not just one, not just the future that any one of us might foresee. And there were no rules concerning the process of prediction. To demonstrate the multiplicity of futures, which he said were as varied as the methods of developing a story, Dad often mentioned a 1970 Doubleday anthology he contributed to, Five Fates. This consisted of 5 stories written by 5 different science fiction authors, Paul Anderson, Gordon Dixon, Harlan Ellison, Frank Herbert, and Keith Laumer. The project creator, Ellison, wrote a first page, which he duplicated for each writer with instructions for them to go on from there independently, without consultation with the others. 5 very different stories resulted from a common beginning, including Dad's, which he entitled Murder Will In. In Dune, Paul Atreides felt a terrible purpose building within, a sensation that both frightened and excited him. He was meant to do something important, but what? The young man had prescience, but it provided him with only fragmentary views of the future and his place in it. He, like Frank Herbert, saw a multiplicity of possible futures. 3 of Dad's novels were published in 1966. In addition to The Green Brain, Ace Books, and Destination Void, Berkeley Books, Berkeley also published The Eyes of Heisenberg, shortly after its serialization in Galaxy as Heisenberg's Eyes. In June, Analog published the short story Escape Felicity, and in August, By the Book. 1966 also saw publication of The Primitives, Galaxy, April, the solo effort that had originally been plotted as a Herbert-Vance-Anderson collaboration. The noted Ace editor and science fiction writer Terry Carr was on the election committee that year for officers in SFWA, Science Fiction Writers of America, which had several hundred members. He asked Dad if he might be interested in running for either president or secretary-treasurer. But Dad declined the offer, saying he was too busy. He felt an urgency to survive as a writer, to break free of the financial shackles of a regular job. This had been a stated goal since his 8th birthday, and he couldn't divert from that course with volunteer activities. Dad shifted to feature writing for California Living magazine, a joint publication of The Examiner and the other large newspaper in town, the San Francisco Chronicle. It was a position he called a fur-lined cocoon,
since his hours were flexible, permitting him time to write. After a few months, he developed a schedule of working 3 long days a week on the magazine, one for doing interviews and feature writing, another for setting up photographs, and another for page makeup. Thus, he streamlined his schedule while drawing a full salary and still performing an excellent job for his employer. The British publisher Gallants purchased the right to publish Dune in the United Kingdom in hardcover and stipulated that they wanted the glossary of terms at the end of the book instead of the beginning. New English Library purchased United Kingdom paperback rights, and the Paris publisher Lafon came on board for French language rights, so Dune was beginning to pick up an international audience. With the income from California living and science fiction writing, money flowed into my parents' household more plentifully.
At my father's insistence, he and Mom took out another real estate loan, purchasing an old farmhouse on 10 acres near Cloverdale, 90 miles north of Fairfax.
This property, slightly closer to Fairfax than Willits had been, was the new site of his dream farm. My mother could only hold on to his coattails. Even when he appeared to be settled, he really wasn't. Things were constantly jumping around in his mind. He plotted out his life as if it were one of his stories, experimenting with this avenue, that one, and yet another. At least now, at my mother's wise insistence, he was investing in real estate, with the prospect of appreciation in value, instead of collecting rent receipts. Frank Herbert intended to remodel the farmhouse himself on weekends, with the help of volunteers such as Jack Vance and myself. The three of us tore the roof off the house and began framing a full second floor, where previously there had only been an attic. Dad scrounged around for doors, pieces of marble slab, frosted glass, and brass ship's portholes, which he intended to install in the home. For safekeeping, he stored them with Ralph and Irene Slattery a few miles south in Sonoma County. Sometimes I brought along my girlfriend, Jan Blanky, and her younger brothers, Dan and Gary, who helped with cleanup. One day, a big mongrel dog came onto the land and bit Dad's leg. Chronically at odds with unruly canines, my father chased it off, hurling 2x4 scraps at it. The Cloverdale property was a lovely spot, overlooking an oak and maple dell where a brook ran. Dad thought this would be an ideal place to write, farm, and conduct his ecological demonstration project experiments. Unfortunately, he was about to face another detour. Chapter 17. Terra. In 1966, Dad was working on a new novel, The Santa Roga Barrier, about an unusual insular Northern California town. The book had a framework based upon the thinking of the German philosopher Martin Heidegger. In his classic 1927 work, Sein und Zeit, Heidegger presented a theory of man's existence in the world, which he called Dasein. The protagonist of the Santa Roga Barrier was Gilbert Dasein. His girlfriend was Jenny Sorge, and in the Heideggerian view, Sorge represented care, things that were within the care of mankind or Dasein. Heidegger believed that man became disoriented and drowned himself in the vastness of the world and in the minutiae of following society's rules. Each man's experiences were too small, too parochial for him to develop a proper philosophy of existence. While working on the Santa Roga Barrier, Dad contracted pneumonia, which laid him on his back for several weeks. He also suffered 2 back injuries in this period, one while lifting heavy building materials for the Cloverdale house, and the other in a fall down the icy outside stairs between the Fairfax house and garage. His spinal injuries were so serious and so painful that at first his doctor thought he might have to undergo an operation to give him a stiff ramrod spine. Before undergoing this irreversible procedure, my father asked for a second opinion. The second doctor thought swimming might benefit him, so Dad went regularly to a nearby public pool to exercise. This helped, but recuperation was slow. For several months, his back hurt so much that he couldn't sit at his typewriter for more than 2 hours a day. I think he had a black cloud over him. While at the laundromat one day, bleach that had been left on one of the washing machines got on his new clothes, ruining a new pair of slacks and a dress shirt. It was no surprise, then, that the protagonist in the Santa Roga Barrier suffered a succession of accidents. In a series of near misses, he is almost drowned, poisoned, shot with an arrow, crushed by a car, and firebombed.
Lurton thought the story had too many accidents. But from my father's point of view, they were in there for a reason, based on his own personal experience. Similar to Alan Watts, Heidegger said man could only come to a full understanding of life and the mysteries of existence by placing himself in challenging, even dangerous situations. My father concurred with this philosophy. In his life and writing, Dad constantly placed himself and his characters in demanding situations where they had to adapt in order to survive. In an essay for Saving Worlds, 1973, he said that we are surfboard riders on an infinite sea, and when the waves change, we must adjust our balance. The single most important survival strength of mankind was adaptability, he said. It would prevent us from becoming extinct. The influence of several great German thinkers could be seen in the Santa Rosa Barrier, harking back to studies my father made with the clinical psychologists Ralph and Irene Slattery in the early 1950s. The book was replete with concepts from Carl Gustav Jung, Sigmund Freud, Carl Jaspers, and others. In the town of Santa Rosa, the key industry was the Jaspers Cheese Cooperative, which produced a drug-laden cheese that bonded the members of the community within an alternate dimension. This, of course, bore more than a passing resemblance to the effects of the melange of Dune. Santa Rosa bore another similarity with my father's most famous work. In the town of Santa Rosa, people attended the Church of All Faiths, a concept that bore a strong resemblance to the Commission of Ecumenical Translators of Dune, which attempted to eliminate a bone of contention between competing religions, the claim to possession of the one and only revelation. The Santa Rosa Cheese Cooperative concept was based upon a famous cheese business in California, the Marin French Cheese Company in Petaluma, near Santa Rosa. My parents went there often. It was out in the country in a valley, and Dad imagined a town built up around it. In the mid-1960s, bohemian cooperatives were springing up everywhere. Dad used to go to one in Berkeley that was a non-profit enterprise run out of a big warehouse, selling groceries and consumer goods to members. It is interesting as well to recall my father's childhood experiences in which he grew up in the town of Burley, Washington, once a socialist cooperative. When Frank Herbert was a star debater for Lincoln High School in Tacoma, he learned how to take either side of an issue. This was necessary in order to prepare for a debate, thus anticipating the attacks an opponent might make. A similar line of reasoning was required of him when he wrote political speeches for Republican congressional and senatorial candidates. Remembering such experiences, Frank Herbert presented arguments in the Santa Rosa Barrier of equal strength to support and condemn the Santa Rosan lifestyle, a lifestyle of strict conformity quite different from that of the outside world. The book was a utopian novel, but presented in such a manner that the reader went away wondering how the author really felt about Santa Rosa. Dad called this concept utopia/dystopia. One man's utopia is another man's dystopia. Around this time, the Examiner offered Frank Herbert the position of wine editor, in addition to his duties at California Living. Dad accepted the assignment, but told management he didn't feel entirely qualified for the position. Actually, he knew quite a bit about wine, having spent some time in the Napa Valley studying vineyards and winemaking methods. Now, since he didn't want to appear inept, he took several days and stayed with a friend who owned a winery, receiving a crash course from him. To further Dad's education, the Examiner also agreed to purchase a number of expensive wine books for his personal library, one of the perks of the new job. Before undertaking any writing task, Frank Herbert did his homework, a necessity, he joked, in order to avoid letters from readers that began, "Dear Jerk." He also began making his own wine, using the bar area of his Fairfax study, which was a converted family room. He favored the Cabernet Sauvignon variety, referring to it as Queen of the Clarets. I recall seeing plastic wine vats and glass jugs on the floor of the study, with plastic tubes running between them in arrangements I didn't understand. On the counter nearby were black and gold stacks of his private wine labels, bearing the face of Bacchus, the Greek wine god, an image from thousands of years before. He had five different labels, Cabernet Sauvignon, Rosé, Chenin Blanc, Semillon, and a generic label without a variety. Each said, "Made by Frank Herbert." Next to the labels were piles of corks and packages of wine yeast, along with jars of enzyme tablets and sodium bisulfate.
He had a brew tester, a hydrometer, and a number of other gadgets, too. He also had beer-making equipment. In 1967, John Campbell of Analog turned down the Santa Rosa barrier for serialization, saying it wasn't truly science fiction. He also felt there were too many loose ends in the novel. Frederick Pohl of Galaxy rejected it, too, feeling the plot was thin, without enough narrative hooks for serialization. Amazing liked it very much and offered a contract. They published it in their October 1967 through February 1968 issues. Tom Dardis of Berkeley Books liked it as well, and published it in paperback in 1968. The loose ends cited by Campbell were placed in the story intentionally by Dad to reflect the realities and uncertainties of life. After turning the last page, the reader was left feeling disturbed and uneasy, with his mind going a mile a minute, like an engine that diesels, refusing to shut off. This was done in Dune, too, as Dad intentionally sent his readers spinning out of the end of the book with fragments of it still clinging to them, fragments that would keep them thinking about the story. In large part, this psychological element was why so many fans read my father's books over and over. It was a storytelling technique he learned early in life, from reading such classics as Tom Sawyer and Treasure Island. After reading the books, he and playmates made up games and events based upon the stories. The stories had not ended with the conclusion of the printed texts. Dad published a short story in 1967, The Featherbedders, Analog, August. He also sold a novel he had been working on for 15 years, The Heaven Makers, serialized in Amazing in 1967, and then published in paperback the following year by Avon Books. This was the story that was based upon the sensational 1952 murder trial in Santa Rosa. It had been written and rewritten several times as we moved up and down the West Coast between the United States and Mexico, with the working titles As Heaven Made Him and Storyship. In 1967, Dad's royalty income dropped slightly from the prior year, and would fall again in 1968. Dune still had not cracked the nut with either Chilton or Ace, that point where an author's royalties exceeded his advances so that he received additional money. The parents of my girlfriend, Jan Blanke, did not approve of me because of my drinking habits. So that summer, she and I eloped to Reno and were married. When we returned to Marin County, Mom and Dad let us live with them for a couple of weeks until we could find a place of our own, a cottage in nearby San Anselmo. At dinner the first night back, Mom took Jan aside and told her, "You'll never be bored married to a Herbert man." Mom consulted astrology and found the intersection of my path with Jan's, where we met. She predicted we would remain together for the rest of our lives. Years before, she had predicted that I would marry a blonde, and this beautiful young woman was very blonde, with French Scandinavian features. The year 1968 started off with an announcement from Terry Carr, the Dune editor at Ace, that they were going back to press for an additional 25,000 copies. 3 months after this printing, Chilton printed more hardcovers. Still, Dad wasn't seeing more than a trickle of earnings from writing sales. He was at work on a sequel to Dune, with the working title of Fool Saint at first, and then Messiah, before settling on Dune Messiah. He also considered and discarded the cryptic title Sea Oracle, representing a coracle floating in a sea of time. He also conducted occasional writing seminars at local schools, including San Francisco State University, whose president was the noted semanticist and future U.S. Senator S.I. Hayakawa. The works of Hayakawa had been influential upon my father in researching Dune, and when the men met, they liked one another instantly. Around this time, Mom came up with a promotional idea, a Dune tarot deck based upon descriptions in Dune. She thought it would go hand in hand with the book and its sequels, garnering additional attention and readership. Through her advertising contacts, she lined up a well-known San Francisco artist who made several full-color prototype cards. Dad photographed the cards and tried to interest publishers and game manufacturers, without success. Early in 1968, Dad again wanted to leave the Examiner and write full-time. He had in mind a book about American Indians on the Northwest Coast, a mainstream story he said had been boiling inside him since his childhood, about a modern-day clash between American Indian and white cultures.
He had been told by government sources that he might obtain a federal grant from the National Foundation of the Arts to research and write such a book because of the historical value of it. Setting aside unpleasant memories of past attempts to penetrate the befuddling walls of bureaucracy, Dad contacted the agency. He requested a grant of $15,000 for a project he estimated would take a year and a half to complete, 9 months of research, and another 9 months of writing. He wanted to hire his friend Howie Hansen as a research assistant, and planned to film and tape Indian rituals, along with many previously unrecorded legends and songs. After getting the runaround from a variety of departments in the agency, Dad was told he had contacted the wrong offices, that he should instead have gone through the National Endowment for the Humanities. He was like a man who had waited in a long line, only to be told he had to go to the rear of another line and start all over again. Frank Herbert threw his hands in the air and gave up the effort, vowing to himself, never again. Jan was pregnant and needed to learn how to drive a car to get back and forth to her doctor's appointments. My license had been suspended for a plethora of tickets and alcohol-related accidents, and I was hitchhiking to my busboy job at a restaurant in San Rafael and to school in Berkeley. While I was at school one day, Dad and Mom stopped by our cottage to visit Jan. When Dad learned she needed a driver's license, he volunteered to give her driving lessons. She accepted before I could warn her that he might not be the most patient instructor. In ensuing weeks, Dad took time off from his busy schedule to give Jan lessons in our little red 1955 Volkswagen. To my surprise, she reported to me that he was exquisitely patient with her, almost to a fault. With my wife's stomach nearly touching the steering wheel, they drove around Marin County, from Fairfax to Novato. When Dad told her how to slow the car down, he said, "Now apply the brakes gently, as if you had a little old grandma in the back seat with eggs on her lap." Mom was as surprised at his patience as I was. I don't recall thinking much in those days about the nice things my father did. I filtered that information out, and from long experience living under his thumb, focused more on his bad side. What I was feeling about him was entrenched in my mind. Little soldiers of hatred had bunkered in there and would not surrender easily. In April 1968, Jan had a 9-pound baby girl. We named her Julie, after Jan's paternal great-grandmother, and gave her the middle name Anne, the same as my mother's. Just before our baby's birth, when we knew delivery was imminent, I got my license back and was driving Jan from Marin County to the hospital in San Francisco. At the exact same time, Dad was in an ambulance on the way to a different hospital. A short while before, he and Mom had been at the SFO heliport in Sausalito, disembarking from a helicopter after a trip to Santa Barbara for one of Mom's plan-ahead projects. On a pathway at the heliport, a speeding baggage cart ran into my father, knocking him down and re-injuring his back. He was in excruciating pain and had to be transported on a stretcher. It was an insane time in the United States and in our family. Only 4 days before, Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated, and now race riots were sweeping the country. Soon Robert Kennedy would be gunned down, too. As Mom and Dad flew over San Francisco on their return from Santa Barbara, she looked down. Not seeing flames, she thought, "Thank God it's okay." Dad began a new regimen of back therapy, with heavy doses of Valium for his pain. His back would never fully recover, and in bed each night he would have to arrange pillows in a special way, jamming them beneath the mattress to alleviate his pain. Later in 1968, both of my grandfathers died, Frank Herbert Sr. and Roscoe Stewart, and my mother broke her ankle. The year was incredibly bad, with two exceptions, the birth of our beautiful daughter and the increasing popularity of Dune. The book was growing by word of mouth, principally on college campuses, where it was being used as a textbook for many courses. Since Dune was an anti-establishment work, it was being referred to as an underground book. Dad received word that the Santa Rosa barrier was also being used as a textbook in a number of college-level classes, and that the sales of this book were increasing on the coattails of Dune. The popularity of my father's work among bright college students pleased him. As a writer of science fiction, he wanted the leaders of tomorrow to receive his important messages and his predictions. If they understood what he was talking about, he firmly believed the world would be a better place. For a small amount of money, A German publisher purchased the right to publish Dune in that country, extending the international list to 3: Great Britain, France, and now Germany. Favorable reviews began to trickle in on Dune. It was referred to as an environmental handbook in disguise, with intriguing characterizations and fantastic imagery. Dad finished Dune Messiah in the summer of 1968, more than 6 months later than expected because of the injuries and deaths in our family. Despite the increasing international respect for Dune, John Campbell refused to serialize its sequel in analog. His readers wanted stories about heroes accomplishing great feats, he said, not stories of protagonists spiraling into oblivion. He didn't like the strong anti-hero theme in the book, giving the protagonist clay feet. After I graduated from Cal Berkeley that year, I went to work as an underwriter for Fireman's Fund American Insurance Company in San Francisco. At the time, my father was not a role model for me, and I had no thoughts of following in his footsteps. My creativity, which I had shown at an early age in artwork and in the writing of childish stories, was virtually non-existent at this point in my life. I felt that if a person had to be like my father to be creative, I didn't want that life. Writing was a profession for crazy people with out-of-control tempers. It was for flakes and penniless bohemians living on the fringes of society. My feelings of antipathy toward my father, justified or not, sent me reeling into an anti-intellectual, alcoholic period in which I opposed most of the things he represented. I would spend my first years in insurance as a functioning alcoholic, reading little except insurance manuals and policies, a far cry from the intellectual world in which Frank Herbert lived. I held down steady jobs, showed up for work each day, and performed what was expected of me. But on a regular basis, I drank myself into comatose states. My marriage hung on, but only tenuously. By the end of the 1960s, California was becoming too crowded for my father. Whenever he went fishing, he kept encountering rambunctious young people who were water skiing, throwing beer cans, and making love in the bushes. He began thinking about the Pacific Northwest again, and so did my mother, for she was a Northwesterner too. Washington State was their terra, glistening brightly in memory, and they realized they had to return. Frank Herbert was a futurist who could see decades and millennia ahead, predicting the course of mankind and the planet Earth. Eventually, he would see many of his shorter-term predictions come to pass. But thus far, at the age of 48, he had not done well in predicting the course of his own life. For years, he had been moving from city to city and state to state, making changes for the sake of change. Now he felt better than ever before about a move. My parents listed their Fairfax and Cloverdale properties, which sold quickly, and sold other personal property as well. In order to give them time to wrap matters up in the Bay Area, they moved with my brother Bruce, who was 17, into a nice apartment on Post Street in downtown San Francisco. While living there, Dad gave notice of his intent to leave the Examiner. The publisher, Ed Dooley, took him out for what Dad referred to as a 3-martini lunch at a nice restaurant on Geary Boulevard in San Francisco. After ordering, Dooley said, "Frank, you shouldn't quit. I pulled your file this morning. Do you realize you'll lose all your retirement benefits? $24,000? I'm not even thinking about that." My father went on to tell him he needed to leave the Bay Area for the sake of his sanity. "Dune sales keep increasing," he said. "The sequel is about to be published, and I have the completion of the trilogy in the works. Ed, I think I can be writing full-time within a year. When I break free for good, for you need to understand I will break free, I want to live in the Northwest." Dad wasn't telling him the whole story, that he still wasn't earning much money from his writing. In the last royalty year, 1968, he received less writing income than in any year since 1964. His last attempt to leave the paper, a short-lived one, had been in 1964. Ed Dooley stirred his drink, looked up, and said, sadly, "You've done an incredible job at the paper, Frank, and we all think the world of you. In 5 years, you could be sitting in my chair." "Ed, I'm truly sorry. You've been wonderful to me, like a father. I'd like to stay. But honestly, I can't afford to." They parted as friends. Frank Herbert accepted the position of education editor at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. This job, involving close contacts with the University of Washington, seemed perfect to my father. It was a stepping stone toward what he hoped to do soon, breaking away and writing full-time. Mom would continue to write for Plan Ahead in the Pacific Northwest, and this income would help set up their new homestead. When my parents and Bruce reached Seattle, they rented an apartment on Queen Anne Hill, in the same neighborhood in which my mother had spent much of her childhood. My parents' large apartment was on the top floor of an elegant old mansion, a white structure with massive Greek columns. Perched on the edge of the hill, it provided a fabulous view of downtown Seattle, including the Space Needle and Elliott Bay. Referred to locally as Cap Ballard's House, it had once been owned by a famous local personality, Captain William R. Ballard. It had a widow's walk on top, an architectural feature said to have been designed so that a wife could look out to sea, watching for the return of her husband. The house was absolutely perfect, with the nautical atmosphere my father loved, in an area where my mother had been happy as a child. Soon they bought a 30-foot cabin cruiser, which they named Arrakis, after the imperial name for the planet Dune, and they were taking trips all over the Puget Sound. They were home. Back to my father's Terra. Another of Frank Herbert's dreams was coming to pass as well. The dream of being a successful author. There had been so many years of research and writing, of rejection, of anger and frustration, of not taking vacations, of burrowing deep into the confines of his study. But through it all, when he really got rolling, his typewriter sang. He made music on it, made love to it, with his fingers floating over the keys, faster and faster and faster. He focused his entire essence on each work, this man who knew so well how to work, and only intermittently how to love. In Dune, he had his literary prize, and a glittering prize it was. Immense fame awaited him just around the corner. Tens of millions of copies would be sold all over the world, in many languages. Decades after its first publication, the book would remain in print, standing as the greatest work of science fiction imagination of all time. A classic novel in which an entire universe was described in tremendous detail. Not bad for a farm kid from Washington State. Dune, a modern version of the ancient Pearl of Great Price myth, is a magnificent pearl of a novel with layers of luster running deep beneath its surface, all the way to its core. During the time that Dad took to create this pearl, a pearl that was nearly as complex as he was, he guarded his writing lair against interruptions, preventing harm to his treasure, his great book. He was like Shai Hulud, guarding the melange of the planet Dune. In taking this course, he lost the affection of his sons. We didn't bond with him. He wasn't our role model. I nearly killed myself with alcohol. My younger brother, believing his father disliked him, was experimenting with drugs and homosexuality. Of his children, only Penny did not have strong feelings of antipathy toward him. But in a good novel, the kind my father wrote, the best and most interesting characters change. They evolve over the course of the story. Frank Herbert, a complex and unpredictable man, would change one day. Forever to his credit. Book 2. Xanadu. Chapter 18. A New Relationship. Somehow, inside yourself, your relationship with your father is something you need to come to terms with. Only then can you go on with your life. Actor Brandon Lee, son of Bruce Lee. My father was one of the most interesting men in the world. His writing was only part of that, a dimension of the man. He had other aspects, fascinating ones. Of all the complex characterizations he drew in his stories, including that of Paul Muad'Dib, Frank Herbert was a more complicated person. He was not a man to be understood readily. Not a man easily read. By long-distance telephone from my apartment in San Francisco to Dad's in Seattle, he and I made something of a truce, without either of us apologizing. We didn't speak of our last confrontation, an argument over my drinking, and went on from there rather uneasily, talking instead about various family matters, how my brother Bruce was doing, and my sister Penny and her husband Ron, who now had three sons, David, Byron, and Robert. Dad said it was beautiful in Seattle, that he was glad to be home.
Then my father surprised me by asking if I might consider moving north.
Maybe, I said.
The month Frank Herbert arrived in Seattle, astronaut Neil Armstrong became the first human to set foot on the moon. In a subsequent conversation I had with Dad, he told me of his tremendous excitement about that, and he added a bit of practicality. We have to get off this planet. We can't have all our eggs in one basket. In his position as educational editor for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Dad met interesting people on the University of Washington beat, including the world's leading expert on land law and land reform, law professor Roy Prosterman. Prosterman invited his new friend to accompany him to South Vietnam to study land ownership, farming methods, and problems of overpopulation, all areas of keen interest to my father. Only 6 weeks after arriving in Seattle, Frank Herbert, the adventurer, had been inoculated against third-world diseases and was on his way to South Vietnam as a war correspondent for Hearst Headline Service, on the payroll of the Post-Intelligencer. Shortly after his departure, I called to see how Mom was doing. She sounded despondent, lonely. "I feel strange when your father's away," she said, "as if a light around me is dimmed." She said she missed his energy around her, his constant ebullience. When she arose in the morning, she no longer heard his typewriter clacking rapidly from another room, a sound which, for its comfort and familiarity, had become music to her ears. She no longer felt his embrace, or, when she was tired, the loving way he massaged her shoulders. It was a time of heavy U.S. involvement in Vietnam, and more than 30,000 Americans had already been killed in action. Many Americans were vocally opposed to U.S. participation in the conflict, and thousands had been taken to the streets in protest. Dad stayed at the USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development, VIP House in Saigon, where visiting U.S. senators and congressmen were housed. He was assigned a car and driver, and his Hearst press credentials permitted him access to the most important people in the country. He also received the assistance of American military pilots, who provided air taxi service, taking him almost anywhere he wanted to go. Now for Hearst Headline Service, he wrote of a bungled U.S. war effort in the region, asserting that our policy was poorly thought out and based upon faulty data and incorrect assumptions. As a result, he said, thousands of Americans were dying. His stories ran daily in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer for the 2 weeks he was on assignment. Each morning, Mom read them and clipped them out. Frank Herbert was, at various times, both a war protester and, almost paradoxically, a member of the National Rifle Association. It is important to understand that he was not opposed to all wars, although we could certainly see the folly of most of them. Wars had a tendency to destroy the habitat of mankind, he thought, the Earth nest. One of his unpublished poems speaks to this point of view, and of the resilience of nature. Boots march past ruins. Then, one blade of grass springs upright, and another.